For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now I can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May I unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth.
And then Taigen.
Thank you, Bo. So for new folks, I'm Taigen Layton, the guiding teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate now. And I am really happy and pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Paula Arai. Amongst other things, Paula is professor of women and Buddhist studies at the Institute of Buddhist Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. The Institute of Buddhist Studies is a Jodo Shinshu Pure Land Seminary, but it now has a certificate program in Soto Zen, which Paula heads, and I'm pleased to be teaching at this year. I've been teaching at IBS since 1994, and I'm very glad that Paula is involved there. Paula, Dr. Arai has written numbers of books. One of them is Women Living Zen, Japanese Soto Buddhist Women. So an important book about Soto women in Japan. Her most recent book is The Little Book of Zen Healing, Japanese Rituals for Beauty, Harmony, and Love. So Paula, thank you very much for coming and speaking to us today. Please take it away. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for letting me join your community this morning. And right now I'm full with yesterday. I was out in Antioch, California. Perhaps some of you know the May We Gather pilgrimage, which was very moving. And the mayor of Antioch had a message of apology to the Chinese who were literally driven and burned out of Antioch. And we placed kata on a monument for the birth of Antioch that only mentions the white people. And no sense of the people there before or the people who pretty much did the building, the Chinese and Hispanics who have supported the place. So we were trying to rebalance the perception of history, and that the mayor was vocal about it was deeply reassuring in these times. Wanted to share some of my newest work in a book that might be called Of Lotuses and Mud, Women Liberating Buddhism. And I choose each of those words deliberately. I don't think there's such a thing as Buddhism, but people have a perception of it. And that's what I'm addressing, that perception. That all people come out of a woman's womb is an underappreciated fact in most historical discourse. I'm glad you saw the humor. Okay. The fact that without a woman, the Buddhist tradition would not have been born is in some ways simplistic and other ways pivotal. Focusing on this fact can help us see how women have been practically, historically, and conceptually vital to the founding and development of this tradition. We know that women have been active since the inception of the Buddhist tradition. It might be even more accurate to say that women were essential to a Buddhist tradition arising, for it was a woman, Maya Devi, who nurtured the Buddha to be in her body. The food she ate were the first food offerings. His second mother, Mahaprajapati, raised him as her own, contributing to his well-being that would eventually blossom into his awakening. His wife, Yashodhara, contributed more love, manifest in their son, Rahula, who would become part of the next generation to pass on the Dharma his father taught. Each of the mothers actively nurtured in their bodies all those who would become the Buddha-to-be's, companions in seeking enlightenment and his disciples. They continue to nurture them with their bodies through their breasts. They use their hands to care for them while learning to walk and while sick. That some sons grew up and wrote down ideas and prescribed rules that did not respect her does not erase her knowledge that her sons were as dependent on her for their survival as were her daughters. In a stream going back, all the mothers who gave birth to these mothers made a critical contribution to what became the Buddhist tradition. In a stream moving forward, all the mothers who gave birth to the children who would pass the Dharma forward so that we here now may connect with awakened wisdom today are integral to the Buddhist tradition. They embody the wisdom that compassion is a concrete act of care. They are proof of the interdependent nature of phenomenal reality. And yet, we have precious few historical records that detail what they thought and did, at least beyond the fact that they were successful in nurturing a tradition that now spans the world and has continued to offer direction to those aching to stop suffering for 2,500 years. What difference might this perspective make on how we interpret women, the Buddhist tradition, even the Dharma? We can hone our ability to see and understand women inspired and energized by the Buddhist teachings on the cessation of suffering and practice of compassion by using these as lenses to interpret the historical evidence regarding women recorded in texts, expressed in art and architecture, codified in rules, institutionalized in organizational structures, and encoded in ritual practices. In lieu of explicit evidence of women's internal thought processes, we can proffer suggestions that take women's agency into account and imagine how one might navigate situations to ameliorate suffering. Women likely took the third noble truth at face value and thought the cessation of suffering was possible for all people. So it is more illuminating to launch our inquiry not with the question, did women seek the cessation of suffering, but rather, how did women seek the cessation of suffering? Adding one word, how, opens up avenues of insight that regard women as agents in their own lives, as caring, hardworking, and serious. Exploring the cumulative tradition from the perspective of women's concerns will help us uncover creative ways women might have integrated teachings on wisdom and loving kindness into their lives. I developed 9 principles to see the Buddhist tradition from a woman's perspective and illuminate how women, or anyone, can wield liberating power That is, experience interrelatedness instead of separateness. My aim is to offer guidelines that encourage practitioners and scholars to see through and beyond constricting and unedifying lenses of Buddhist teachings and practices. 1. Breathe space for not knowing. It is beneficial to remind ourselves how little evidence is available to know how most people thought and felt throughout history, especially those without resources or inclination to record their own contributions. It behooves us to also keep in mind that the lack of evidence is not evidence of lack. In consciously foregrounding the countless neglected threads from our current version of the fabric of reality, we breathe space for new information, insights, and perspectives. We open up space to explore and imagine. 2. Look through expansive and contextualized lenses. Given the sleuthing nature of a recovering or imagining how women might wield liberating power, it is beneficial to look through both expansive and contextualized lenses. To see any specific event in the context of its broader surroundings is critical to ascertaining the impulses coursing through what has occurred or is transpiring. Oscillating between wide-ranging and tightly focused perspectives can generate insights that arise from juxtaposing shifting viewpoints. Decentering and recentering information promotes fresh awareness, often bringing to light concerns, concepts, and values that influence people. 3. Account for our interdependence. Accounting for our interdependence illuminates the fact that nothing occurs in isolation, and everything has ramifications. It beckons us to not ignore, dismiss, or discount anyone in our effort to understand ourselves. The crux of interdependence is a koan. How do we wield liberating power in a context that is replete with oppressive institutions, teachings, and practices? 4. Navigate with one eye on ideal aims and another eye on raw realities. As with any effort to fathom human activity, it is crucial to explore what people face in their lives, aspire to, and assume about reality. Not losing sight of ideal aims safeguards us against the imagination-dulling effects of bitterness and cynicism. Keeping an eye on raw realities safeguards against ignoring, diminishing, or dismissing the experiences of people, especially those who are perceived to be inferior. 5. Examine the impact teachings or practices have on suffering. Absence of conscious intention to cause suffering does not mean that suffering does not result. Our interrelatedness notwithstanding, teachings and practices that may be skillful in one situation may not be in another. Therefore, it behooves us to be vigilant in assessing whether teachings or practices have the potential to be oppressive. Notice whether the people who advocate the teachings or practices hold positions of structural power. Consider the substantiation offered to support a pronouncement especially if it asserts inferiority or incapacity of some people, like women can't be Buddhas or something. If no proof is offered or the reasoning is not compelling, resist accepting the assertion, even if it is in a text ascribed as scripture or authoritative, and if it is made by a person broadly recognized as a leader or teacher. 6. Assume women want to stop suffering. I was surprised when I came up with that, and I realized, yeah, that's not a universal assumption. To assume women, really everyone, want to stop suffering is humanizing. It acknowledges sentience as well as highlights self-respect and agency. Anticipating a person's motivational drive, it facilitates discerning what they might have cared about and what they thought was worth working hard for. Imagine women experimenting with ways to ease the hardships that often attend birthing, nourishing, clothing, and housing a family, nursing the sick and caring for the elderly and dying. Except for birthing, these activities are not necessarily women's work. They are essential work, though, and women tend to perform this work. To acknowledge that such work is often done by women is not to relegate them to such work. Rather, it validates the women who make these critical contributions to their community. Reflecting on what would not be possible without this work is a way to see what women valued and deemed worthy of their support. Recognizing women's activities is integral to the functioning of communities will yield a more dynamic and understanding, a dynamic understanding of the challenges people face. To balance the abundance of information about what men thought and did, intentional effort is required to recover and understand women's contributions. Keeping in focus the needs, resources, and challenges of the whole community will enable us to fill in important dimensions that were accomplished by women. That so many people survived childhood and many even make it into old age indicates that women developed ways to allay suffering and cultivate life-sustaining wisdom. 7. Move through an embodied perspective. An embodied perspective of Buddhist liberation is practical. It examines if a teaching mitigates suffering. It experiments with a practice to ascertain if it meets a need. If not, then one explores other routes until an effective one is found. An embodied perspective does not tarry on abstract notions of right, wrong, or good, bad, for it sees morality and virtue as acts that do not cause suffering. It seeks ways to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. It promotes identifying and analyzing the dynamics of a situation as well as prompt potential liberating strategies. 8. Seek compassionate interpretations of teachings and practices. Dharma teachings and practices are those that, after having been tested, are verified to effectively liberate beings from suffering. What is helpful for some, however, might not be helpful for others. Ascertaining that which effectively allays suffering is the key to wielding liberating power. For some teachings and practices that cause suffering have been incorporated under the vast umbrella of the term Buddhism. In the process of identifying that which is effective, it is important to humanize the authors of sutras and teachers of practices. When encountering a situation that produces suffering, blaming, shaming, or accusing are understandable responses. However, in being inherently divisive and driven by incomplete perspectives, however, they do not extract the root of a problem. Nonetheless, understanding the dynamics behind actions that cause suffering is central to sorting out what ameliorates suffering. Therefore, seeking an interpretation that both acknowledges the problem and discerns what would effectively stop the suffering is a more skillful response. I call this approach a hermeneutics of compassion. It involves measured reflection and is not quick to generalize or judge. It is not a veiled way to find excuses for perpetrators and blame victims. Nor does it exonerate discrimination. Sometimes the compassionate response to teachings and practices is to not follow them, for they are not effective in helping you stop suffering. In short, a hermeneutics of compassion assesses what kinds of actions, including thoughts, might be liberating. 9. Learn or imagine how a woman wields liberating power in response to negative treatment, structures, or environments. We can enlist our imaginations as a tool to open our minds. It can stimulate reinterpretations of available material that have been considered from an androcentric perspective. Exploring ways women might have responded to negative treatment, structures, and environments will enhance our ability to interpret such events. By extending the sweep of our attention, we can expand our knowledge of women's ingenuity, insights, and strengths. These 9 principles of a woman-centered hermeneutic can help us weave subtle detail and luster into the fabric of our Buddhist narrative and open us to recognizing the many ways Buddhists, past and present, respond to suffering and seek liberation. I have a story, but I want to insert a quick piece of information. I learned recently that you've perhaps heard of the Nyonin Kekkai, the women not allowed to go to up on the mountaintops like of Hiezan and Koyasan. Well, there was a woman who had Buddhist sculptures made, and although her body was not allowed to go up, you know, walking up, she put her hair inside the Buddhist statues and donated them, and they accepted them. And I thought, wow, this is back, I forget which century right now, but quite many hundreds of years ago. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I wasn't planning on saying this. And that's just one example of the ingenuity we have recorded, and how much more has probably not been recorded. Anyway, just a quick example. So this is... I wrote a story based on Queen Srimala's sutra teachings on Tathagata Garbha, the Buddha's womb, are ripe for examining a woman's perspective on a woman's capacity to be enlightened in a female body. Indeed, one of the main texts that advances the Buddha's womb teaching, the Sutra of Queen Srimala of the Lion's Roar, delivers the teachings through a woman. The sutra is dense with philosophical and technical language. As a Buddhist scholar, I can imagine how the teachings would be more accessible and inspiring if they were conveyed through a story that draws out the relevance for those with physical wombs. My story weaves together textual and philosophical points from the sutra. I listed them and checked them off when I got them into the story. The conversation I depict between the queen and her female attendants is a creative expedient for bringing the philosophical teachings to life. Queen Shramala was delighted, though not surprised, when the dutiful messenger delivered a letter from her parents. They had always cared for her with rich opportunities for growth, never intimating that a daughter was any less capable than a son. Devout Buddhists, they envisioned her aspiring to heights beyond her position at the pinnacle of royalty. Wanting nothing less than her full awakening, they encouraged her to study the Buddha's teachings. In due time, the Buddha predicted she would become the Buddha of universal light. He praised her explanation of the Dharma. This is quoting the English translation. "Excellent, excellent. Your wisdom and skillful means are most profound and sublime," end quote. Queen Shramala's teachings went on to become an authoritative force for the pivotal teachings on Tathagata Garbha. Sorry, my sun is rising here. I'm looking away from it, but I know my face is probably washed out. Oh, well. One day, with head bowed, five attendants approached Queen Shramala. "Beloved queen, in what way may we best serve you?" The queen: "I have called you to my chambers today because, as young women, you may have been treated in ways that make you question your worth. Our world is filled with ignorance. Such defilements conceal the seed of awakening that lies within each of us. Let me share a teaching that has freed me from doubts and delusions. It is called Tathagata Garbha, Womb of the Buddha. Though its wisdom is lofty, you can integrate it into daily life. The primary thing to do is live virtuously, which means to pay attention to your actions, especially if any, including your thoughts, are motivated by greed or dislike. Such motivations cloud your ability to see clearly. One of the hardest things to see clearly is the nature of self, because things are not entirely what they appear to be. Through our senses, we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. They provide practical information for navigating life. For example, if someone has fallen, you can assist them because you have eyes to see and arms to lift them. Daily life is full of such opportunities to behave virtuously, and our senses are central to that aim. Yet, our senses can lead us astray, for they only reveal part of reality. If we live as if our senses inform us about the whole of reality, then we act in ways that are not fully informed. This invariably leads to results we do not want. We inadvertently generate frustration, dissatisfaction, and sometimes anger. In this way, we produce our own suffering. An attendant: "Oh, dear queen, we do not want to live that way. How do we become fully informed?" "You already have all you need. When you are honest, live with integrity, and sincerely aim to cause no harm to yourself or others, you can trust what emerges from your wombs. They are powerful sources of wisdom. Listen deeply. Wombs provide the conditions for allaying suffering and activating enlightened activity. they are by definition the perfect conditions of compassionate care, providing all the nourishment and protection needed to grow and thrive. Indeed, being pregnant is bodhisattva work. You are cultivating a Buddha in your body. To nurture an embryo of a Buddha is a momentous responsibility. It is also a major contribution to our world. Carrying a being in your womb is excellent practice for how to live all the time. Since caring for an embryo is concrete and has high stakes, it can spur you to intently cultivate compassion. Focus your senses on awareness of the conditions you are generating. All your actions affect the embryo. Do not worry, though. You cannot stain the purity of the embryo. Your womb is pure, but you must be careful not to coat it over with defilements, such as exposure to toxins and intoxicants, being selfish or callous, and getting overly stressed. Please be sure to eat healthy food and get sufficient hydration and sleep. Spend time in nature where you can hear birds sing and feel fresh breezes on your face. Caring for yourself is to care for the Buddha growing in you. To protect yourself from harm creates an environment that protects others from harm. Many women have found that it is easier to be virtuous while pregnant. Their wombs tell them that each action has a direct and immediate consequence on the embryo. Since they are living for another being, they are keenly motivated to be aware and to care. Being conscious that the self is not an independent entity is also easier when pregnant. It can also help dissolve the delusion of being a separate self. The corporal connection through the umbilical cord between you and an embryo is direct. In a concrete way, it demonstrates the nature of how all is ultimately interdependently connected. Is this teaching helpful if you don't give birth? My beloved, you do not need to have or use a womb for this teaching to be effective. Wombs, as perceived through our senses, offer only one perspective of reality. Since through another lens of reality, the womb is the liberating wisdom of emptiness. Through this lens, all boundaries are impermanent, fluid, and ultimately empty of intrinsic substance. Hence, all beings are wombs of Buddhas. Whether you are pregnant or not, have a physical womb or not, you can visualize yourself as pregnant with a Buddha embryo. All your actions can be done with the intent to care for that embryo. Anyone can live with this awareness and cultivate genuine compassion for self and all beings, turning the world into a womb for Buddhas. You enliven this world by nourishing and protecting all beings with loving care. Whether you have your own children or not, please share this teaching. It is important that all our children develop this wisdom. We have the capacity to stop suffering because all of our bodies are vehicles for birthing Buddhas. The Blood Pond Sutra, a late 12th century Chinese apocryphal sutra, reveals how ingenious women can be. Women in China and Japan developed strategies to navigate the scripture that contended that all women go to a hell pool filled with blood spilled during childbirth and menstruation. Evidence suggests women who were not primary wives in medieval China found the sutra helped them in their relationships with the children they birthed. Socially, all the man's children were considered the children of the primary wife, regardless of who the biological mother was. When a non-primary wife died, her biological children had no ritual to properly grieve her, because her funerary rites did not acknowledge her as a mother. The Blood Pond Sutra provided the impetus. The sutra asserts a woman could be released from the blood pool hell if her children were filial. In a Confucian-based society, encouraging filial piety supplanted the convention that sundered mothers and their children, at least in death. The Blood Pond Sutra began circulating in Japan during the 15th century. Japanese women also created ways to have the sutra support them and not just denigrate and oppress them. Taking cues from evidence of what women in Japan did, I narrate a story that animates how women did and can wield liberating wisdom when faced with a Buddha's words that deems their bodies a source of suffering, arising from their capacity to give birth. Our story begins in a village at the foot of Mount Tateyama, a towering volcanic mountain known to have a blood pond hell. This is historically true. Women who live there come to life through passages from Tora-san's diary, the name I gave. In the first entry, Tora-san is a newly married 17-year-old. October 20, 1848. I went to my first gathering of the 19th night group last night. I am still shaken by the sutra we chanted. The older women there seemed unfazed by it. Afterwards, some even laughed about it. How can they take it so lightly? They clearly understand something I don't. I do seem to be behind in learning about some women's things. I guess that's not surprising since Mama died giving birth to Kiku. Having helped raise my younger sister, I look forward to having children, especially since I have keen thoughts about how not to do it. Our stepmother treated us as burdens, even though when we tried to help, I would not have even known about this women's gathering had my new mother-in-law not encouraged me to go. There were about 15 women there last night. Although I was a bit shy being introduced as the newest and youngest to join the group, I felt warmly welcomed. It was comforting to be surrounded by women who were near my age as well as women who had clearly weathered many seasons of life. Some were quiet. Others were somewhat outspoken with a great sense of humor. I felt like I belonged. Like the lack I felt growing up without my mother would be filled. We did a short ritual. There was an endearing carving of Nyoirin Kannon on a low table at the front of the room. The women rotate who is to bring flowers and food offerings. One of the elder women lit a candle and incense. Another woman rang a bell, indicating when to bow. After three bows, we chanted the Heart Sutra. Like most people, I could chant by memory. Then they began to chant a sutra I had never heard of before. Why were women in hell wallowing in a pond full of menstrual blood and forced to drink it, beaten with an iron rod if they refused? Wasn't a sutra supposed to be the words of an enlightened being? What is going on? The part about washing out our monthly cloths, polluting the water tea is made with, is infuriating because women are very careful about such things. A man must have written this. The ritual ended with prayers. Some prayed for getting pregnant. Others prayed for a safe birth for their baby and themselves. Women added prayers for sisters and friends who were not there, some because they were caring for sick children. After the personal prayers, the women intoned a formal prayer in unison. This is paraphrasing the actual sutra. May all women be released from the blood pond hell and be reborn in Buddha's land. Most of the evening was spent sharing stories. One elder woman, who seemed to be a special visitor, guided us by weaving wisdom into her tale of affliction and adversity. The night drew to a close with a bell and a bow. As I was walking out, a middle-aged woman came over to me. She had an especially warm smile and a sparkle in her eyes. Her name is Kane-san. I immediately sensed her care. She is how I imagine Mama would be if she were still around. I miss her. November 20, 1848. It's hard to believe 1 month has already passed. During casual conversation over tea, I felt like I was being initiated into a woman's world of unvarnished honesty and humor. When one woman complained about her cramps, a refreshingly salty woman named Kuma-san exclaimed, "That's why we don't have to do certain rituals and such when we're on the rag. Men think they're controlling us because we're polluted, but really, it's because they're afraid of blood. They have no idea that their rules are really giving us a break when we need it most. Besides, who wants to move around a lot and risk soiling our clothes? There's enough extra laundry as it is." Kane-san even chimed in. She thought these rules were humane because they gave women time to rest and be restored by having a respite to reflect. These women's gatherings are fantastic. January 20, 1849. I missed my period. This is the first time it's happened. I'm usually so regular, so it must be. Before going to the gathering, I was a tumult of emotions. I was excited about becoming a mother, but fear of dying like Mama felt like a typhoon roaring through me. I was especially paralyzed with the thought that, I can't even say it, that a storm would return my baby to the waters. My best friend is still struggling to get up and prepare food after what happened to hers. When I shared this at the gathering, I could feel the fear of dying in childbirth ripple through the circle of women. Tomi-san chanted Namo Amida Butsu under her breath. Kane-san walked over to me, held my hands, and looked deeply into my eyes. "You are not alone, Tora-san. We are here for you." As we chanted the Blood Pond Sutra together, instead of being repulsed by it, I felt embraced in a wave of understanding. Their voices bathed me in compassion. They all prayed for me with sincerity that made me feel it would be all right. February 20, 1849. Kane-san gave me an amulet to protect me through pregnancy and delivery. She had traveled to a Kumano Bikuni, a kind of Buddhist nun known for understanding the types of suffering women face. It turns out it was the elder woman who had shared a powerful story that first night. I joined the gathering. Kane-san trusted this nun, so she wanted to get the special Blood Pond Sutra amulet from her. There are many Kumano Bikuni who travel around supporting women with teachings and these special amulets. I peeked inside the cloth amulet. On very thin paper, a copy of the Blood Pond Sutra was inside. May 20, 1849. My belly has suddenly swelled, throwing off my balance. I've learned that means things are progressing on schedule. Kane-san knew how to wrap the long cotton sash, a hara obi, just tight enough to support my growing belly and relieve the strain on my lower back. She tucked the amulet she had given me in between the folds of the obi so it would stay close to my body. I felt both protected and less back pain. August 10, 1849. My daughter, Hatsu, was born. We are both safe. The Blood Pond Sutra amulet works. Of course, the women and their prayers saw me through, too. October 18, 1855. I've been so busy raising my children, I have not had time to write. Today, though, I must write. We all gathered for Tomi-san's funeral. She died in childbirth. I carried a small statue of Myoiden Kannon to place on a large flat rock we used as an altar at the edge of the blood pond. Others brought food offerings that, as the sutra prescribed, we would later feast on. We came to this desolate place on the craggy mountain for funerals. The aroma of sulfur cast a solemn pale over us. The sutra assures liberation for those who hold a blood pond liberation service, which includes chanting the sutra and doing a secret ritual shared among women. We took a quiet moment at the edge of the pond. In silence, we each reverently held a blood pond amulet to our bowed foreheads. The amulets rent the pond as we threw them to set free our prayers for Tomi-san. Then, as the sutra instructs, we placed a copy of the sutra into a boat and set it afloat on the pond. The sutra promises that after doing so, a five-colored lotus flower would appear in the middle of the blood pond. As the sun sank lower on the horizon, a few women went with me to place the Nyoiden Kannon on Tomi-san's grave. I have come to trust that women would not be condemned to the blood pond hell. I believe the sutra not only assures safe births, but that if a woman did die in childbirth, she would be reborn in the Pure Land. May 24, 1856. 8 days ago, I gave birth to my fourth child. Tomi-san was on my mind. My father-in-law gave my son the name Kennosuke, as I had done with my other three babies. For the first 7 nights, I did the ritual to invoke Jizo Bodhisattva's protection. It's especially helpful while recovering from delivery. I removed the paper from the blood pool amulet. The 7 Sanskrit syllables for Jizo's Dharani are written on it. Om Ka Ka Kabisamange. Each night, I carefully tore off 1 Sanskrit syllable and swallowed it with a glass of water. For extra protection, I also whisper the Heart Sutra. Today, I went to the temple to receive a fresh copy of the sutra and return the one that had served me. I always feel comforted keeping the sutra close to my body, especially until I'm fully restored from the birth. It seems like a long time ago when I was disturbed by this sutra. Now I see that the sutra brings women together. When we gather, we naturally support each other. This is what makes the sutra so powerful. I don't know how I would have survived without my 19th night group. June 2, 1857. My younger sister, Kiku, gave birth to her first child today. They are both safe. I'm sure the amulet helped. When the time comes, I will give one to her daughter, too. One last story from my ethnographic research. When I meet Tanaka-san, she is in her 80s. Her blazing wisdom is a force of nature that draws people to seek her counsel. I tell her I want to speak with her about healing, and she responds by sharing a story so fresh in her memory, as if it happened yesterday. Perfection tormented her when she was younger. Adopted at age 7, she never wanted to be a burden to her new parents for fear she might be abandoned. She never relaxed, striving to ever behave like an ideal daughter. Though they treated her well, she believed she was never good enough. Upon becoming a mother, aching to be a good mother, she agonized over the competing obligations of working and mothering. Mothers who worked outside the home were ostracized and evoked animosity in 1960s Japanese society. Believing she could only be a good mother if she did not work outside the home, she convinced herself she failed at mothering. With demoralized heart in hand, she risked repercussions at work to chaperone one of her children's school field trips. As she walked along the hiking trail, feigning fun, her charges bobbing along in their uniform yellow hats, the deep-rooted pain over not being a good mother pierced her. The trail opened to a pond. Rising high above the murky water, majestic soft pink lotuses blossomed. She trembled at the beauty embedded in such foul water, seeped through the walls of shame she had built in her heart. The blossoming flowers embodied the verity that beauty can grow in mud. Riveted to the scene, her heart finally broke open like a dam, flooding her with an unfamiliar sensation of possibility. Healing wisdom washed over her as she saw through the fallacies that had held her captive. She saw that her circumstances of her life were not a condemnation of her value. Tremendous energy devoted to hiding the tenacious and insidious fear that undergirded her drive to perfectionism quivered through her body. After the undulations ran their course, she felt emotionally drained. Yet, for the first time in her life, she knew she was strong and worthy. She realized she was a lotus. The muddy conditions of her life were the source of her power, not the cause of deficiency. Freed from her self-imposed captivity, she looked around and saw her daughter huddled among classmates, squealing with delight at the discovery of baby ducklings trailing their mother through the lotus pond. Tanaka-san realized that her love for her children was enough. They were being raised to be curious and open to the wonders of the world. Pressure to conform to a social ideal of motherhood no longer had a grip on her. She now saw mud as a fount of life-sustaining nutrients. Perfectly sterile environments are not. People, families, society, and nature flourish because of mud. Tanaka-san was liberated by the insight that mud is the only place lotuses blossom. Guided by the Zen healing activities Japanese Buddhist women taught me, which in turn informed the 9 principles I developed for seeking and discovering Buddhist women's liberating power, past and present, future too. I hope my imagination to bring to life the Buddhist historical record and philosophical teachings. May you too see how women could and have activated Buddha Dharma in ways that liberate themselves, others, and yourself.
Thank you so much, Paula. We will take time now for anyone who has comments, questions, responses in the Zendo or online. Bo, maybe you can help call on people. And please feel free to respond to Paula. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.
Someone from the Milwaukee Zen Center.
Good morning. This is Raven. I'm the resident priest here at the Zen Center. And I thank you so much, Taigen, for inviting Paula. And I'm so moved by your talk, Paula. This was really beautiful. And I have one question. I think you have already mentioned this, but I would like you to talk more about what about those beings who don't have a female womb? You know, all the different genders that, you know, that are there. That how can we practice as if we had a womb and if we were also generating Buddhas?
Yes, well, that's exactly it. You, the senses and the physical forms, I actually designed the story the way I did quite deliberately to make those without wombs feel like maybe, well, what about me? Because that helps you understand all the women who've been like, I'm here. Can you see me? Because our senses, as I mentioned in the story, are only part of reality. That the Tathagata Garbha teachings are really about we are all wombs of Buddhas. And to nurture that seed of Buddhahood in ourselves, regardless of what kind of bodies we have or think we have, or and not even, I see it this way, maybe Taigen Sensei has a different view, but it's not even limited to just humans. The whole universe is a womb for Buddhahood. Because of interdependence, how could it not be? It's just the, you know, our, to continue expanding the perspective is the, I think, the path to accepting your body with or without a womb and to start seeing everyone as wombs of Buddhas, everything as wombs of Buddhas.
Jan.
Thank you for calling on me. I was intrigued by the whole talk, and I have a lot of thoughts about what you said. But the first thing that caught me was the first thing you said, that you think Buddhism is not a religion. And I have said this to people many times, and they say, yes, but you have a practice, but you have a body of literature, da da da. You are, Buddhism is a religion. And I lose sight of why I felt Buddhism is not a religion. It was the first thing that attracted me to Buddhism, that it was not a religion. And I wonder if you could talk more about that or something.
Yes. Well, I have given this a lot of thought. First, as many of you may know, this word religion in English really develops around the late 1600s. Before, there was only an adjective, religious, and it referred to a quality of being. And then when it became a noun, it got labeled. People used it. And if you recall your history, you know, that was the time a lot of Christians were running around the world trying to tell people what the real truth is. Mm-hmm. And they called, it was a pejorative term. They called other people their religion and they went around labeling them. You notice Christianity is not an ism, but there's Buddhism. There used to be Mohammedanism. And thank goodness the Muslims spoke back and said, no, we're Islam. But Hinduism and people didn't have that self-identity. And now the word religion has an expanded meaning and Christians even see it as something positive. But the word religion, most languages don't have such a word. That was not a category, how they broke up the pie of what they think is going on. The Japanese added it in the late 1800s because they started translating documents. And so they came up with this word, shukyo. It was an older word, but they began using it as a, you know, the translation of the word religion. But it's like a Band-Aid. You know, yeah, they have it, but, you know, you can ask lots of people. And this is a 1980 survey. I'm not going to get the numbers right, but you'll get the point. Some sociologists went in to ask people, are they, you know, do they follow Buddhism, Shintoism, Christianity? And it was a come out to something like 80% are Buddhist, 70% are Shinto, you know, 10% are Christian. And the sociologist from the West is like, well, that's a lot more than 100%. And it's because it's a category that just, you know, isn't baked in. And they're just trying to answer the question the way they think the Western, you know, sociologist is trying to, you know, they're trying to give the right answer to the sociologist. And it's just not a category. So even though now Japanese and then one of the rare terms that Chinese translated got from the Japanese, usually it's the other way around. So the people have been using, figuring out a word, but it's not baked into the sense of who are we and what are we doing. When the word develops, when we get these words, Buddhism, Hinduism, Wolfram Cantwell Smith, his book called The Meaning and End of Religion develops this more. If you want to hear more of his thinking, I'm one of his students and I totally bought his arguments because it held up everything I learned, all the history, that people then started dividing into silos. I'm this, I'm that. And he points out how fundamentalists and liberal people within a given tradition, you know, fundamentalist Muslims and fundamentalist Christians often have more in common with each other than people who have they hold the reins loosely, I'll put it that way, on their tradition. And this term actually, to talk about religion, to codify it as this entity, this thing, removes us from our just a raw humanity and connectedness. We lose sight of it because if we take on identity, you know, I'm a Buddhist and I follow Buddhism. Well, then when you talk to someone, you know, who's, I don't know, a Hindu, then even though the vast sharing of history and concepts, you may see, oh, they're different. And then you're looking for common ground in a way that's just built into the history and the cultural overlap. And so this concept has made it harder for us to connect in the way the so-called religious teachings are trying to cultivate in us. And so that's why he says, you know, get rid of the word religion. And so ism is just a remnant of imperialist visions.
Imperialism.
And, yeah. So, you know, that is grounds alone to not use it in a way that is as if it's reflecting what people think of themselves. But I'm toying, I'll take feedback of using it in the title almost to have a straw horse to take down, maybe.
Could I get something off you? Oh,
go ahead.
I've noticed that people who really agree with each other and are in the same group will begin to hate each other over some small detail. Because, you know, if you don't interpret everything exactly to the letter the way I do, you're just wrong. And there's something wrong with you. I have to say that you see this over and over where people split up over the tiniest thing when they have almost everything else in common. And that's it for me.
Well, that's why I put in the I forget my exact own wording, and I don't even know which number it is, but of to not judging, to have a compassionate interpretation, because it's so easy to judge and blame. And so we have to keep reminding ourselves, especially, you know, I make an exercise out of anytime I've found something that, say, you know, the men who wrote the sutras, you know, it's not the revealed word of God. Real men wrote these things. That when they say, you know, a woman can't be this or that, it's easy to say, okay, so he just was misogynist or androcentric or, you know, looked down on women. And not that I don't agree with those assessments, but I want to get at what is underneath. What is it they fear? Or how is it that having that concept helps them liberate? Maybe it doesn't, but I at least need to consider. Maybe there is something liberating in it for them. And so, you know, we know about the practices of, you know, monks going to meditate on corpses. And, you know, if it's female corpse, then it helps them overcome desires. And, you know, if that helps them release some attachment, so they're not lusting after women, like, I don't mind. You know, I appreciate the diminishing of the lusting. So if it helps them, it's just if it gets generalized to, well, then all women are somehow bad. That's when you introduce the suffering. But the basic practice might not. I leave open that possibility. Yeah, Brian.
Oh, thank you very much. First of all, I want to nominate you for the narrator for all Buddhist sutras because you have a marvelous way of dramatizing and expressing what can be sometimes some dry text. And first of all, just a shout out. I'm aware of you through Tyon Michael Elliston, who referred to you, and then subsequently I bought your book, Painting Enlightenment, which is one of the most gorgeous Dharma books with that artist who paints the Heart Sutra into so many things. So thank you very much for bringing that into being. Again, there's so many ways one can understand a womb. Thanks again also for highlighting the Queen Sramala Sutra because, you know, there's so many Tathagatagarbha sutras and it's not often highlighted that, you know, this was an actual woman who was speaking about wombs. So I guess, I don't know if this is a question or an observation that it strikes me that what you've done very well is illustrate, not only the reality of women, the physical embodied actual reality of women in the relative world, but the need also for the wisdom of emptiness, the ultimate womb of Buddhas or awakened mind, to realize that all of our categories, and it's usually through language that we have these categories, that we foreclose and shut down and fixate on certain ways of being that we think have to be because of our language. And, you know, it just strikes me as the liberating power of the Dharma teachings is this very thing, not to lose the actual womanness of women, and what specifically, how they differ from men, but to also not be limited by those definitions and those categories, and certainly the cultural baggage of patriarchal societies. I don't know. I guess this is less of a question than just a. It's always stunned me when I encounter sexism or racism or any ism based on some random detail of someone, and not, you know, when people don't relate to each other as just conscious, sentient, sensitive, you know, human beings. So I think you're doing amazingly wonderful work. Keep at it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've got two chapters of this book written. I've got two more to go. So I will have your voice in my head encouraging me. Because I'm kind of getting a little, I don't know if radical is the word, but I am going to include, I took on all the scriptures, sutras that I found problematic. And I don't say in those stories, because I don't want to judge in the story, but in the explanations, I think I want to say more explicitly that I do, but I try to say it nicely. But I might say it in a more pointed way, that if a sutra, just because a sutra says something, to let's not just believe it. I mean, that's so not according to the Dharma, that right. We're supposed to investigate and experiment. And so I have a whole thing about the 8 extra rules for women. Mm-hmm. I don't think historically there's enough evidence to say that Shakyamuni Buddha made that a condition on women joining, but certainly later it developed, and women did, and men thought women should follow them. But then my next chapter I'm working on is taking all the problematic practices and rules and how could you work with them. And so I realized with the, you know, the no matter how old a nun is, she must bow to a man, monk, boy, no matter how young he is, new in the Dharma. And so I imagine, okay, 80-year-old nun, 7-year-old boy, and she's bowing to him. And I'm thinking, okay, and this is the embodied perspective part. Take the embodied perspective. I'm thinking an 80-year-old woman bowing to a 7-year-old boy, she's probably thinking he's like my grandson. And she really wants him to enter the path of not suffering. She's not feeling, oh my God, this is so misogynist. I've got to bow down to this little boy. That's not what she's thinking. She's thinking this little boy is a precious being by the time she's 80. And then I think the poor boy, what? Yeah, and each time you bow, you know, you're helping dissolve that delusion that you're separate. And that poor boy gets bowed to even by senior elder women. And what does that do to his delusion? It may inflame it. And then that practice makes it harder for him to stop suffering. And so I'm really trying to, that embodied perspective is, I keep taking, okay, if I were this person, if I were that person, what does it feel like? What might it do to me? And granted, you know, I'm projecting, I'm just me. But it's an imaginative exercise that helps me start seeing, oh, possibilities.
There's a tradition, Tibetan, every time the Dalai Lama meets someone, you know, they bow to him, but he bows to them, you know, and it strikes me that, you know, evolving certain practices so that there's mutual bowing.
Yes.
Might be one way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And equally as low, because you can still bow, you know, bow at different levels, and there's still some power.
Yeah.
Higher.
When you strip away all of the, you know, physical accidental differences of birth, et cetera, according to the teachings, we're all Buddha. We are all enlightened, awakened mind, et cetera. So where is the distinguishing characteristics there? That's the whole point. There are none. And we are all equally this wonderful potential. And so that's my hope, is that we can evolve towards that.
Thank but remember, form is important. Yeah.
And Paula, thank you so much. We're quite a bit past our usual time, but
but
to have you here is such a gift for us. So I want to say, if there's another comment or two, let's continue. But please try to keep it brief.
We have Eve here in the Zendo. Would like to make a comment or a question?
Question. Yeah, I just have a brief question.
Yes.
Thank you very much for the talk, and I found it very helpful. And I hope to be able to share it with others. And you just said something about, it sounds like it's part of a book. I was just wondering if you have a written form of it that you're circulating now.
Not yet. It's a draft. But I'm grateful for the feedback and encouragement.
So how soon do you think it'll be?
Published is longer than done. This is 24. We'd be lucky if it's out by the end of 25, published and done. And that's fast, as far as books are for me. That's really fast. But the publisher takes about a year, so I'll probably be done maybe at the end of this calendar year.
Thank you so much, Paula. I look forward to that book. One more comment, if anyone has a comment or question or response for Paula before we stop. Oh, someone must.
It's okay.
Well, I guess I just wanted to say I find it helpful, not just for people with wombs, but for people thinking about anyone who's a member of a group that's been disparaged, and being able to give guidelines for how to access your power for liberating not just yourself, but others.
Yes. 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 Thank you for that. I am very concerned that I'm not reifying the category woman, using it in the title, and I try and throw in here and there, or any person. But the reason why I'm not ready to give up the word woman in the title and to focus it on women is I don't want to so quickly move to, oh, it's all emptiness, because that makes it easy for people to not care. Compassion is concrete. It's not an abstract activity. And so we must look at particularity. And so I just want to draw attention to the women, because I'm in a field where that's seen as maybe not as scholarly, not as rigorous. And I just don't agree.
And you mentioned ethnography, and I'm an ethnographer, and I feel, you know, the power is that you get to the profound through the particular.
Yes.
And yeah, I feel that's disparaged, or I've worked in fields where that's disparaged, for getting, when you get too close to the particular, it's not seen as, quote, scientific. So thank you for that, too, and for being willing to mine the details of experience.
Mm-hmm.
of embodied experience. Yeah.
Thank you all for your attention.
I think there's one more comment or question from the Milwaukee Zen Center. Let's do that.
Okay. Okay.
This is Miguel.
Hi. Yeah, you were talking about how lack of evidence doesn't mean evidence of lack, and which I think is very true for lots of historical studies on this, you know, this kind of topic. And I was wondering, like, what do we do with that lack of evidence? And I think you went into it a bit when you talked about embodied perspectives, but I was wondering, like, what you think we can sort of do to sort of fill that lack of evidence.
One of the things we can do is, I still hear I want to call it the dominant Buddhist narrative prevalent in the field of Buddhist studies, but also in popular culture, that somehow through most of Buddhist history, women were oppressed and subordinate to the men. But most of Buddhist studies is filled with the elite monastic male perspective. And so I see it as that is one perspective. I'm glad they did so much homework. They got a lot of information I value too. But I'm seeing it increasingly as a narrow perspective, not just a male perspective, but as a narrow perspective. And so let's expand the lens and see what else was going on and put it in a larger context. And so I sometimes think of it in terms of weaving. Like, we've got this really tight weave, no air in between, because it's like, this is what we have the evidence for, and a tight weave was made, making this story. And I'm saying, let's loosen up the weave. Breathe some space into, we do that through our imaginations, like my stories. I'm not trying to say history was like that. I'm just saying, maybe it was. So then when we're reading something, we might, like, hear something different, or we might look especially at marginalized people as maybe they were very creative in how they navigated things. And so sometimes the most creative, agile method doesn't leave traces. So you didn't rile up somebody's defenses, and then there was a big, you know, conflict over it. Maybe to navigate is to stay under the radar and you're just floating free. I don't know. But when we look at freedom as public institutional support, we've limited what liberation might look like. I could go on and on, as you can tell. And I'm loving talking with you, but I don't want to keep you here all day.
Thank you so much, Paula. We'll close now with the four Bodhisattva vows and then brief announcements. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. We vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We vow to realize it.